if you looked at the email handout, you might have gotten scared seeing how many slides there are, but a lot of them are pictures. So we're still talking about proofs and kind of the backgrounds of why we believe what we do. And we're right here. We're going to do New Testament archaeology today. And so some of you might say, well, this is going to be really boring. We already believe the Bible. You know, it's there, kind of like teaching the alphabet to a college student. You kind of already know it. It's basic. But for some of us, this is proof of what we believe in. For those who don't believe in the Bible that we're talking to, sometimes you have to say, well, let me find some stuff to get, so you might say, well, the Bible is true. I want to study it. And so just going to start going through some things and see. So one of them is the city of Nazareth. And so there's just a couple points we'll do when we look at this. But the city of Nazareth is a huge city today. It's about 40,000 people. But what we don't realize is in the first city, this was a very small village. As a matter of fact, Josephus doesn't even mention it when he lists the 40 cities that he mentions in Galilee. Nazareth doesn't even take mention because it only probably had about 200 to 300 people. So the modern city, the Church of Annunciation right here, sits either on or close to where probably the original city was. There's a convent just up the road up in this area where they dug down in their basement and they found some old first century houses and some tombs and that type of thing. But it's been estimated that the whole church complex covers more ground than the entire city did in the first century. So it wasn't much. So when you think about this, the king who was born in a stable grew up in this very insignificant city. And so definitely not the person that the Jews expected when they think about the king that was coming, the Messiah. But in Luke 4, where Jesus said, Isaiah has been fulfilled today in your hearing, and then they go to throw him over the city, off the cliff. We don't know where that was, but it's been estimated that this might be it. So if you go from the city and come up, it sits almost like out west on a mesa. It's not quite as flat-topped, but it comes down. And so if you get up top and look down, you could have thrown somebody off this cliff. So this is assumed where this took place. How about Capernaum? Well, five of the apostles, we know four were fishermen, one was a tax collector, or from Capernaum. And when you start looking, it makes sense this was a fishing village because the city itself was right on the Sea of Galilee. And if you look at some old photographs where they were first starting to excavate, you can see this kind of weird structure right here, kind of octagonal shaped. And now there's this building put over it. Well, if you go there today, you can see they've done a lot of excavations, and a lot of these are typical houses for that time period from the first century. And there's a kind of a squatty spaceship building sitting there. It's actually a church. And what it is built over is this octagonal structure built over a fisherman's house. And so it's also covered in Christian graffiti from very early on. And whenever the Byzantine, after Christianity was legalized, the Byzantines, when they found areas that were important, they would kind of hallow them and they would put an octagonal structure around them, signifying that this was kind of spiritually important. So this is thought to be actually Peter's house. Do we know? We don't know. But actually, early on in the 300s and 400s, people thought this was Peter's house due to either tradition or they just picked a house. But they found a lot of fishing gear, things that fishermen from the first century would have used around this area. There's also a synagogue. This is probably from the 3rd or 4th century. It's a very beautiful synagogue that they've kind of pieced back together. But what I find interesting is the synagogue, the foundation stones, it's not square on the foundation stones. So as you get further to the north, they line up evenly. And then as you get further south, they're a little bit off. This is the foundation of a first century synagogue. So you can actually go to this area and stand in the 3rd or 4th century synagogue over probably where Jesus would have been every Sunday or every Saturday that he was in Capernaum. So I just find that fascinating. It doesn't prove anything, but it's really neat that you can go and see these places. Remember, the Sea of Galilee, is actually below sea level. So when they say the water levels are high, it actually gets closer to zero. It gets further the lower it is. But there was a series of droughts back in the 80s, 3 years of drought, and it uncovered all of these little harbors that had been hidden for years and years and years, which tells you a couple things. One, there was a lot of fishing going on, a lot of transportation. But the second thing is, during Jesus' time, the lake was a lot lower. So you can get into the whole global warming and global change and climate change, but stuff changes because these were buried for a long time under the water as the lake levels went up. And after a series of droughts, we actually saw them again. But this lake actually was important. In AD 73, there was actually a naval battle on it. When the Jews were revolting and the Romans, there was actually some naval battles that Josephus was involved with. But after 3 years of drought, these two brothers who had been walking along saw a couple sticks kind of sticking out of the mud, got kind of excited, said, well, maybe this is something important. They called an archaeologist. He said, nah, it's nothing. He said, it's got to be something. So they called another guy who came in and said, oh, yeah, that looks important. Let's dig it up. So over 12 days and nights, what they did is they excavated, and the wood was so just fragile. It was paper thin, almost like wet cardboard. It had been buried so long that they had to put this polyurethane spray to keep hold it together. And so over 12 days and nights, they actually had armed guards. They were doing this, and they're racing because it had just started to rain after 3 years of drought. So they didn't want to lose the low lake levels. So they brought it in, and they put it in this actually special container. And first thing they did is they put some fish in there to eat any kind of bacteria and microbes and things that were there. And then after they got all that out, they started putting polyethylene glycol in, slowly increasing the amount in there, so it basically solidified this soggy wood. And they did this actually over 7 years. So if you think about excavating and doing things, it took them 7 years to get this boat where they could actually do something with it. But what they found is this is a typical first century boat. It was actually made out of 10 different pieces of wood, so either there wasn't much wood or they were very thrifty. You think about our ancestors here when they went out west. What did they do when they moved? They burnt the house down and got all the nails. Because you could get wood easy, but you couldn't get nails. So they'd go through and they'd collect all the nails after they burnt their house down when they were moving. And so here, you would have four people rowing. You'd have a room for a mast in the middle. But can you imagine putting 12 people, 13 people in this boat? A big old windstorm coming, somebody sleeping. You worry, we're going to die, we're going to capsize. You can see why the apostles were very scared. How about the Pool of Bethesda? This was actually made about the 8th century. It's on the north of the Temple Mount. And people, it got lost until the 1800s. It just got buried over. We couldn't find it. And so there have been other things built on top of this. But people said, well, the gospel writers didn't know what they were talking about. They wrote later because they're talking about this pool that's not even there. And then the 1800s, somebody discovered there's one side that's been really excavated. There's a central kind of dam, and then there's another side that really hasn't been well excavated. How does Luke describe the healing of the lame man? Well, they mention that this had five porticos. So you'd have had one, two, three, four, and the fifth one running down the middle. It makes sense. And you start realizing that, well, maybe Luke and the gospel writers knew what they were talking about because we had forgotten about it. We didn't know about it until we actually excavated it. But this was really deep. It's 13 meters or 42 feet deep. So the guy needs some help getting into the water. There's probably reasons for that. Now, last week we talked about Hezekiah, or 2 weeks ago, about Hezekiah and the Gihon Spring. But you'd start at the Gihon Spring. If you walked the tunnel, you'd come out in, for the last couple hundred years, what they said was the Pool of Siloam. But we said these measurements don't quite work. They seem too small to be the real pool. But the Byzantines had built a church, and here's some foundation pillars over this. And this pool was probably for ritual cleansing and cleaning, but it just doesn't quite match up. So go ahead to 2004. And during construction of a sewer line, which the new one is here, they uncovered some steps. So they started digging and excavating a little bit more, and they realized, oh, this is a pool. And so this is what an artist thinks the pool looked like, but if you notice right here, this is all that's uncovered right now. A Greek Orthodox church next door does not want to lose their fruit trees, their little orchard, and so they haven't allowed excavations to go on. So we just kind of have a guess as to what the rest look like. But this really matches up with a first century pool, a Herodian pool, something that would have been used for the Jews for cleansing. And so from here, after you get out of the pool, you can walk up and they've excavated all the way up to the Temple Mount. There's a road that you would have walked up after you got cleansed to go into the temple. This is where the man born blind was told, hey, go wash and you'll be cleansed. You remember that story about, you know, well, that's not the guy born blind, and the family says, well, it is, but we don't know how he was healed because nobody wanted to admit it was Jesus. How about Lazarus' tomb? We know that Lazarus had been buried twice. And so in the first century, in early second century, this area actually has probably one of the best sites for having tradition saying this really happened at this exact spot. Over time, there have been churches built on it. And so they actually built a mosque. So the original entrance would have been this way. They had to dig a new entrance through the rock. But if you go in through the cave, you can see that the Crusaders actually put rocks to line it. But Lazarus would have been in here. Jesus would have called him, and he would have come out through the tomb. Is this where it really happened? We don't know. Has tradition going back to probably the first and second centuries. And of the tombs and the caves in this area, this is probably the best that would fit. But truthfully, nobody knows. What about Caiaphas? Remember, he was the high priest who said it would be best for Jesus to die for the nation. Now, if you know how the Romans did, at this time the high priest didn't follow the way that Moses had laid out in the Pentateuch. Because the Romans said, well, this is something that we can use to keep power, so we're going to slowly give it to different people. Now, Ben means son of, so you see, son of Aeneas, son of Aeneas, son of Aeneas, son of Aeneas. They all kind of kept it in the family. So they kind of rotated whenever the Romans needed somebody, they'd find somebody else in the family to be the high priest. But Josephus, based on the dating, tells us Joseph and Caiaphas would have been about the time of Jesus. Now, with this, if you think about it, we call him Caiaphas. It's like I answer to Kingsley. It's my family name. Well, my first name, nobody knows. Everybody calls me by my middle name. But I answer to Kingsley. So same thing in this time. You would actually answer to your family name. And so they were building a park in actually 1990. And they found what looked like a tomb. And so they pulled the goal plug. So not everything had rolling stones. Most of them didn't. They were actually a stone plug that would have been put in. And they found all this debris. And so when they start cleaning out the debris, hidden in the background here, they see some ossuaries. And they pulled a lot of ossuaries out of this tomb complex. Some were very plain. Some were very ornate. Generally, the more wealthy you were, the higher rank you were, the more ornate you were. So if you run across something like this, you know this person was very important or very rich. This one in particular, on the side, if you can read Hebrew, it would say, Joseph, son of Caiaphas. And then when they got into it, they realized there's bones from six different people here, including a 60-year-old man. On the other side, it just says Caiaphas. And so, most likely, this is confirmation of what Josephus and the Bible talks about Caiaphas. What I find really cool is, here is the first time that we can say pretty well that somebody that we read about in the Bible, here are his bones. We actually found bones of somebody that we read about in the Bible. To me, that's really neat that you can actually get that specific. Now, on the other hand, Pontius Pilate, he was a Roman ruler in Palestine. Now, 100 years later, Tacitus, who's a Roman historian, called him a procurator. And so everybody says, well, Luke called him a prefect. Luke got it wrong. But then in the city of Caesarea Maritime, Here's the theater that's been kind of restored. Most people know about it because of the aqueducts there. It's very beautiful. You got the ocean there, the aqueducts bringing all this water in. But they found a stone in 1961, and so a replica is kind of at the place. It was used as a paving stone. So just like reusing wood in boats, you got a stone. I don't know who this pilot guy is. Let's just put it up, or we don't care about him. So they flipped it over, and were using it as a paving stone. And so you can go to the Israel Museum and see the original. But what does it say? It says, Tiberium Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judah. So here it matches exactly what Luke had called him, and it matches the time period. And so this is the first time that they'd actually found the names Pilate in a non-biblical source, carved into stone. Since that time, we've found some parchment, so more proof that Pilate was a real human being. But this was the first time. And it also, we discovered that the word prefect was the correct term for his position. That actually lasted from 60 to 44 AD, and then it turned to a procurator. So once again, we weren't that smart. We were criticizing text when we didn't have all the facts together. So this is more just for your own edification, but we talk about the 15 Psalms of Ascents. And so outside on the south of the Temple Mount, they uncovered steps from the first century going up to the gates that would have gone into the Temple Mount. And they alternate long and short. So you got a short one, a long one, a short one, a long one, kind of requiring you to walk in the slow, almost like a processional, thoughtful type of march. You're like, well, why would you do that? Well, you're getting ready to go into the area of worship. It's kind of like we'll dim the lights sometimes and say, hey, we're getting ready to start worship. Everybody calm down. Here, they did it with steps. What I find interesting, though, is there's 15 psalms of ascent. There's 15 sets of these steps. Could that have been so that you would maybe read each one on each set of two? I don't know, but it's kind of neat. The Soreg. In Acts 21, remember when Paul is actually at the Temple Mount, some Jews from Asia see him and they're like, oh, he was with that Greek guy. He probably brought the Greek guy into the temple. Whole city's in an uproar. They're going to kill Paul. The Romans rescue him. Josephus tells us that around the Temple Mount there are these stone markers warning the Gentiles not to come closer on pain of death. And they were these white marble written with red paint. They're about an inch high. And what's interesting is Tiberius, when he conquered Jerusalem in AD 70, he said, we gave you so much leeway here, and yet you still didn't do what you needed to. The Jews weren't allowed to commit capital punishment. They had to ask the Romans, except if they crossed the barrier, didn't matter who you were, Roman citizen or not, they could kill you on sight. That was the one thing the Jews were allowed to do. And so the statement said, no foreigner is to enter within the balustrade and in the embarkment around the sanctuary. Whoever is caught will have himself to blame for his death which follows. So we read about the uproar. We find archaeological evidence that, well, they would have known better bringing a Greek into the temple. You remember where Peter is asked, does your master pay the temple tax? Well, of course he does. And then he goes and asks Jesus, do you pay the temple tax? And Jesus says, who's supposed to pay taxes, the son or everybody else? Well, the son's exempt. It's like, well, I'm exempt. But since you already said that, we don't want to offend people. Go collect a coin out of the fish's mouth and pay it for both of us. So the temple tax was a half a shekel. What's interesting is these are the coins that you would have used to pay the temple tax. Who's on the front of it? It's a god, Hercules. Or Heracles, depending on how you pronounce it. But there's a god on the front. These were minted in Tyre. And the Jews required these. Why? Because the silver was known to be very pure. They knew what they were getting if they accepted one of these coins. To the point when the minute Tyre shut down, the Jews petitioned the Romans, and actually the Jewish authorities minted these in Jerusalem, the same coin, because the Romans said you can't change anything, but you can mint it. And so so they minted it. So it's very consistent in value. So when Jesus criticizes the Pharisees and the rulers Do you think this might have played a part? That here you're accepting something that's not kosher to pay for the temple tax because you want the silver more than you value graven images. Kind of fits with the biblical story. How about crucifixion? We were told up until the 60s that the Bible, there's no evidence for crucifixion. People would not bury someone who had been crucified. They were outlaws. They were criminals. And then we found an ossuary that says John, son of Haggal, and his heel bone had a nail through it where he'd been crucified. And on the other side, they could see parts of the wood. It had apparently hit a knot and bent, and so they couldn't pull it out, so they just buried him with this spike through his heel. And so after the ossuary, when they opened it, they found it, proving that you could actually have a good burial after being crucified, and we found proof, the first actually proof of crucifixion, all in one shot in 1961. Before that, everybody said the Bible's not accurate. So what about the tombs? We read about it was a new tomb hewn out of rock. They put a large stone. There were two angels sitting, one where his head and one where his feet. And then even if you go back to some of the Old Testament where it talks about resting with your fathers. And so here, this was actually Herod's family tomb. And you can see it was hewn out of rock. And there's a rolling stone that would have gone in front of it. There's other ones we've found. This one had been the best one in Israel at Kirbat Midrash. But in the 1990s, some vandals went in and destroyed parts of it. But here's a rolling stone that would have rolled across. Not all of them, though, had rolling stones. A lot of them actually used these goels or the plugs where you would have put it in. Now, these actually go back a little bit. These are more Iron Age tombs, but a lot of similarities where sometimes in a more elaborate tomb system, you would have an antechamber. And you would have individual rooms that you would go into. But the Jews, if you remember, the body had to go back to dust. So you would not fully embalm. You would just basically put some spices so the stink wouldn't get too bad. And then you'd leave them there for a year. So you could actually slide bodies into the kokim. Or you could lay them out. And if you notice, here's a little headrest. So I guess you can only use them one way. When you're doing this, but you'd leave the body there for a year. Sometimes you lay the body out in an arcosolium, and this is what I think probably the tomb Jesus was laid in looked like, because here you got spots where you could sit people on head and foot. This is actually the largest tomb as far as the number of bodies that could be laid out. So you can notice the little headrest. You would have fit a number of people there. But you can picture, actually, some of these, you can picture an angel sitting at the head and at the feet of where he had laid, saying, the body's not here, you're looking in the wrong place. But with these tombs, a lot of times you will have the area, and then if you notice a little hole right here, a little thing underneath, if you look underneath, they just keep throwing body and bones and bones and bones in there after the bodies have decomposed. So was this important that this be a new tomb where nobody else had been laid? Who was resurrected? Was it Uncle Frank? Was it Grandpa? You know, whose bones? You don't know unless it's a brand new tomb. And so very important that the scriptures tell us that, because otherwise you don't know who is resurrected. But you literally would be with your family. Going a little bit further into Acts, how about Sergius Paulus? Remember when Paul went to Cyprus and there was a Jewish exorcist who was blinded? When Paul was talking to Sergius Paulus, well, afterwards, he actually went to, he was administrator over the Tiber River in Rome, so we eventually found some stuff there, but this actually rock was found in Cyprus in 1877, and it mentions, and so between this and some of the data that we have from around Rome, it fits the chronology of Acts very well. So when Paul went to Cyprus, and he was ruling there. The Bible and this extra-biblical text just mesh really well. So how about Corinth? Well, Paul spent a lot of time there. It was 50 miles east of Athens, and it's estimated in the first century that Athens had a population of 30,000. Corinth was 300,000. Because Corinth is on an isthmus, and you notice here's one side and here's the other side. And so it was very unsafe to go all the way around, sailing around the southern tip of the Peloponnesian peninsula. So Corinth here basically had control. If you wanted to dock here and bring your boat over here or move the goods over here, it was a lot safer, a lot quicker, and Corinth prospered. And so from the Acro Corinth, you can kind of look down at where the main city was. And so it was a very immoral city. When you went, they actually built a road where you would drag your boat. You could drag small boats across this four-mile isthmus. Now, the French have actually dug a canal that you can travel. But so with all that money coming in, you had a very prosperous city. And so here's some of the excavations. Here are some of the shops on the west side, and you can actually hear the running water that would have run the fountains. It's still there coming off the Acro Corinth from some of the springs. You have the Temple of Apollo. Now, in its day, the word a Corinthian girl wasn't a nice term. It was a term for a prostitute. To Corinthianize was to practice immorality. That city was so bad, those terms were just colloquial, used as euphemisms. But if you go up on the Acro Corinth, so most cities had some kind of an acropolis. And so the Acro Corinth had a fortress for protection, but there was also the Temple of Aphrodite. Had over 1,000 sacred slaves, i.e. male and female prostitutes. To go worship, you would go sleep with the prostitute. And so, very immoral. This is actually a picture from Ephesus, but you can imagine these being in Corinth as well. This is an advertisement for a brothel. And so when Paul says, and such were some of you, immorality was rampant. Is it any different today? The immorality, how rampant it is, the fact that and such were some of you, we all have baggage that thankfully we had our sins washed away, but still, we all have done things. We need to guard ourselves because there's nothing new under the sun. While he was there, how do we time our trip to Corinth? Well, we know that Paul was dragged before the proconsul of Achaia, or Gallio. And so the Jews dragged him up there. Gallio said, it's not my problem. He drove him from the judgment bench. And so in 1908 in Delphi, the Greeks, remember, had their oracle at Delphi, they found some stones. And underlying here, Gallio, G-A-L-L-I-O, Gallio. So this dates, because of this, we can date this Gallio and Paul's stay in Corinth to AD 51 to 53. So it helps us to look at Acts, and all of a sudden, still matching up. Sergius Paulus, Gallio, we're finding these little bits and realize Luke was right on target with what he was saying. What else about Corinth? Well, if you read in Romans, Paul was in Corinth. He said, Erastus, the treasurer of the city, greets you. And found on a sidewalk, it says, Erastus, in return for the aedileship, laid the pavement at his own expense. So an aedile was responsible for maintenance of public buildings, regulating public festivals. So is this the same Erastus? Maybe, maybe not. It is interesting, though, that the city treasurer greets you. And then here somebody is, the city Adele, is laying the foundation at his own expense, kind of as a thank you for electing me. Is that the same person? I think so, but we don't know. How about the judgment seat that they got thrown from? The word is bema. And in 2 Corinthians it talks about we must stand before the bema of Christ. So these were judgment seats, but they could also be used for lectures, for businesses, for trials. This is the one at Corinth. It was a huge stone platform. You see the Acro Corinth here. But that was unearthed in 1935, and we found a number of these throughout the Roman Empire now. But we talked about Ephesus. Paul spent a lot of time at Ephesus. And the kind of the big thing is we talk about the amphitheater where everybody went when they're having this riot. and the Artemis or Diana, the goddess. So here's for your own edification. I had to throw this one in. You think you have it bad when you sit in a stall and somebody's in the stall next to you at a public restroom? How about this? You had flowing water front and underneath. You had mosaics all over. But there's no stalls. It's just you and 30 of your best friends. So times have changed. They still have running water, but where we have porta potties. So I don't know. You get running water, but friends are, I don't know which is worse. But anyway, so in Acts 19, Demetrius the silversmith, losing business. So they have the riot. They all go to the theater. Well, this was discovered in the 1800s. And you can see here either Greek or Roman crane, you know, trying to rebuild it here. But this is a huge theater. It would hold 25,000 people. So when it says the whole city was in an uproar, and here, yeah, 25,000 people would fit in this. Now, what were they in an uproar about? Well, the goddess Diana. Well, just about a mile and a half away from here, we have stacked up one of the pillars, but that is all that is left of one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, the Temple of Artemis. But we did find an Artemis statue there. Now, this is what they worshipped. So typically she would have something on the chest. Either these are breasts, testicles, or seeds. Nobody really knows, but something dealing with fertility. And she would have animals hanging off the bottom. And so uniformly she's generally drawn and carved the same. Now normally she never has legs. They're always together because a lot of times initially they would carve her from a tree trunk. I don't know if it was harder to form legs out of a tree trunk, or if it's because with this fertility and the whole, you know, she's part tree, part goddess, I don't know. But the legs were always carved together. Now, the Romans actually brought idol worship, well, the Greeks did and then the Romans did, back into the land of Israel. So this was actually from AD 130, when after the destruction of Jerusalem, they rebuilt Jerusalem. And this was actually found in Israel, dating back to about 130 AD. How about Philippi? You remember Paul went, there wasn't a synagogue because they had to go outside to meet where people were worshiping. And so they met where prayers were being made. Paul and Silas got dragged to the marketplace to the authorities and thrown into prison. So if you go to Philippi today, just outside the city, there is this river. So somewhere around here is where Paul converted Lydia. But if you go up, kind of back on the Acropolis and look down, you can see right here where there's going to be a forum. And so this is where Paul and Silas were dragged after they healed the woman who had the demon. Now, is this the right jail or not? They were brought here to the Bema, and right close to it is what is called the jail. And so they assume this is where Paul was imprisoned. We don't know. So most of this is coming from Acts. And y'all remember Luke wrote Acts. Well, he was criticized for not knowing what he was talking about. One of the people who criticized him was Sir William Ramsay. And so back in the 1800s, he was a non-believer. He was skeptical of Luke. So what a good skeptic should do, though, is he studied. He wasn't closed-minded. He said, well, let me just prove this guy wrong. And he was open-minded, and he said, wow, Luke verified 32 countries, 54 cities, 9 islands, 13 ruling figures, all historical that we have found or that we know. So he said Luke knew what he was doing. He was a good historian. But one of the words that Luke is criticized for is using the word politarch. And he uses this in Acts 17 while describing the rulers of Thessalonica. And the problem is, we didn't find this word anywhere else. And so everybody said, Luke doesn't know what he's saying. He's using some weird word. And then in Thessalonica, you'll notice modern city. So there's not much they have uncovered because it's built on a modern city. You have to be able to dig and have a reason to dig down to find stuff. But they found a gate called the Vader Gate. And it's in the British Museum. And on it, it's inscribed in the time of the Politarchs. using the same word that Luke was criticized. Since that time, we have found this over 35 times, and five of those have been from things found in Thessalonica. Luke was accurate. It seems it was that area that used that term for the rulers. That's why he didn't use it to describe Pontius Pilate. He wasn't a politarch. He was accurate in what he did. Now, more for helping you understand some cities, some of what you read, Laodicea, we read about in Revelation. And they are told, I know your works. I wish you were cold. I wish you were hot. You're neither. You're lukewarm. I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. And so, if you get there, it is in between two cities. So if you look from Laodicea up towards where Colossae would have been at the base of this mountain, Colossae had cold running waters coming off of the mountain. But from Laodicea, if you look, you can actually see across the valley this white stuff. This is hot mineral spring calcium-laden water. People go to Yellowstone and lava hot springs and different places here in the country for these waters. And this time, they would go to Hierapolis. And as the water sits there, it's boiling hot. You know, it cools off a little bit and it forms these beautiful calcium carbonate structures. Laodicea had neither of these. They had to pipe their water in. So you can actually go and find water distribution areas. You can find all these pipes all over. The problem is, hot water piped in gets lukewarm by the time it gets there. Cold water piped in gets lukewarm when it gets there. And it's mineral-laden. A lot of these pipes that have been used for a lot are very narrow, and they kept having to relay newer and newer and newer pipes because they would be mineral-laden. So do you think this hit home when they read in Revelation that you're lukewarm? They knew exactly what he's talking about. And they had a very vivid reminder of yucky water. If it was cold, I can drink it. If it's hot, I can bathe in it. I can't do either. And so it hit home for them. How about Pergamon? We're told in Revelation, I know you who are where Satan's throne is. So this city, if you notice here, some of the temples, Trajan, Hadrian, Faustina, who is Marcus Aurelius' wife, these are emperors and emperors' wives. They had temples where people worshipped them. This is actually one of the first places where they started persecuting Christians. And so when you go there, you have to go up on the Acropolis, and you can look down, and here's the Temple of Zeus. Steps going up to the altar, but there's no altar. Now, why is that? And you've got to go to Berlin to see it. Because the Germans were excavating, and they have something called the Pergamon Museum, where they have a lot of these things. Next week, we'll look at some stuff that's there relating to the Babylonians. But in the 1800s, as the Germans went and excavated, they would find things of interest, and they would take them. Now, thankfully, they did. They and the British and the French, because a lot of these areas were just taking all these rocks and reusing them and rebuilding, and we wouldn't have all these things today. Now the question is, now that the countries recognize the value of these, they're wanting them back, so people are arguing who owns these. But you can go and you can see the altar for the Temple of Zeus. But what else did you have? Well, right next to it you had the Temple of Athena. Actually, would have sat here, there's not much left of it. You also had one of the steepest theaters in antiquity. So the base of this, if you walk this way, you'll end up at another temple, the Temple of Dionysius. And then, actually, if you looked from here off this way, there's a whole another temple complex related to healing, the Asclepian, so the Greek god of healing, who was actually a man who got deified. But it's impressive if you go how much work was put in. This is actually support structure for the temple complex ahead of it, on top of it. What was on top of it was temples built to the Romans. So this is actually Trajan, the Roman emperor. This was where his temple was. So when Revelation says, you who live where Satan's throne is, Is it because of the persecutions that were coming? Was it because of all these temples, temples to Caesars and their wives? Don't know. But it definitely does fit. And so with 138 slides, I ran through them quick because this is the last one. So here is, again, I'm going to close with the same quote, Nelson Glueck. He says, "I have spent many years in biblical archaeology and in company with his colleagues, and I have made discoveries confirming in outline or in detail historical statements in Scripture." If you remember last week, he said something similar. He said, "Digging with the trowel in one hand, the Bible in another, and I've never found anything that contradicts what we read about in Scripture." So, we actually have time for some questions, because I never give you all time unless you throw up a hand. But next week we'll do prophecy, and then we'll get into... So we go from stuff that nobody really argues much about anymore to something everybody argues about. But questions? Comments? Yes? Well, and this is what we mentioned, one of the first things. You can prove all these things, but it doesn't necessarily bring you to faith. You can say this is an accurate document based on digging, but it might not lead you to a belief in the God it's talking about. And so that's the problem with a lot of archaeologists is they don't mind. They're like, oh yeah, the person writing about this, they knew this area and it matches, but then they don't dig a little bit deeper and say, what else does it say? And so that's actually one thing we're going to get into later is, did Jesus live? Okay, well, if he did live, what did he say about himself? And that, to me, is one of the biggest things for Christianity is just, what did Jesus claim for himself? I wish it happened. You know, a lot of astronomers now believe that there is some kind of a being who created the universe. They argue over who that is and what he is, but they all know it had a beginning based on the evidence. Other comments? Questions? Okay. Thank you for putting up with the roller coaster.